And so basically what the initiative is at this stage, it's about collecting signatures from the people to garner interest in this topic. And so it's, you have the initiative, the text has to be read by, I don't remember the name of the legal bodies, but just to make sure that it's not totally bananas. And then after that, the initiative is sort of distributed to the people. So it could be door to door. When you go to vote, oftentimes you'll see people outside of the voting station with a copy of their initiative, and they give you sort of the quick and dirty, and then you can read more if you want to. And then you literally, you have to write your name, your signature, where you live, your phone number, like everything has to check out to make sure that it's actual Swiss citizens who are interested in this topic. And then once 100,000 signatures are collected by the people who are heading the initiative, then it can go out for a vote amongst the entire Swiss population. So it's like, for me, that's incredible, because you really get a sense that when you're engaged in your community, when there's something that you believe in that you feel will actually make a positive change, you can do something, and it is possible to achieve a desired result. The initiative to add Bitcoin to the Swiss Constitution, it may not pass, but through the process, you're actually raising awareness about Bitcoin, about why someone would propose Bitcoin as opposed to gold, which I do believe is part of the current constitution. Why are people talking about Bitcoin? You know, like, why not just the Swiss franc? You know, like, it does provoke conversation. And I think that's sort of the bigger goal in all of this. But I know it sounds totally nerdy and dorky, but it's really cool to participate in something like this.
Hello guys, welcome once again to BitConner Podcast. I hope that you have following the previous episodes. I know it's crazy. We have been talking about ordinals, real estate, Hollywood, a lot of things. But that's part of what I promise in this season. Because now that we have been doing this for 2 years, now we can explore further about Bitcoin, even about Nostr, learn about Nostr more even. By the way, I finally managed to upload the podcast on Nostr. So you can watch it up there. And we will continue doing that as far as we can. So yeah, today it's another special episode, because as a previous one that we had a couple of weeks ago, there's another host coming to the podcast. So yeah, host sharing our Bitcoin experience, but you will find out right now. So I don't want to say anymore. I just want to welcome Saida, that she is the host of 21 Questions. So welcome.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Juan. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Yeah. So actually, guys, we have met in Barcelona and the Bitcoin. We had that. No, sorry. It's not a Bitcoin conference. It was a cypherpunk conference in Barcelona involved Nostr and Bitcoin. It was quite great. We had already, you saw the episode with the guys from Vol Bitcoin, and well, you have seen Kiki, another person as well. So yeah, but what happened in Barcelona stays in Barcelona.
Yeah, the conference was so good.
Yeah, actually it had a really good feedback. That's what I was talking with Theo and Science, that we had zero expectations because it was the first one, not because we didn't know what we were doing, just because it was the first one. So the first one, it can happen whatever, right? But people, we really had a really good feedback on that, especially because we had time to actually have networking and connect and talk, which is different with the other Bitcoin conferences. You know how huge they are, right? So people are happy about that. And I'm glad that you said that.
Yeah, it was totally awesome. I have to say, and I just interviewed someone based in Canada, Adam O'Brien, the CEO of Bitcoin Well. Yeah. And he too went to a smaller conference in Alaska, and the feedback was pretty much the same. Small conferences are so good for connecting with people and starting to build relationships. They're very human. If you're a bit introverted, like I am, you know, you can like have like a smaller group and just have side conversations. They're really nice.
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't know that it already happened, the Alaska one. Kiki told me about that one, actually. Yeah, but it's nice that they're having good feedback. And I think that should be the trend, right? Like to have a small conference to actually connect, because in the end, you need to meet other Bitcoiners in other ways to just to connect and see how you can help them or they can help you and to continue building in this space, crazy space, by the way.
Yeah.
But yeah, all right. So I always want to start a podcast if you can share a little bit about your background. I have some hints and people have told me that you have a unique background. So I don't know how much that's on to you. I'll give you a blank space on how much do you want to go deep on that. But yeah, share us a little bit about your background and your story. And then we will go into the Bitcoin rabbit hole journey.
So we don't have a lot of time, so I won't.
Yeah.
Maybe I won't go like too far deep into my background.
All right.
But like, I guess the TLDR is that I'm born and raised in Toronto in Canada. My family is from Trinidad and Tobago. There's a pattern here. My parents immigrated. My mom actually immigrated from Trinidad to the UK. My dad immigrated from Trinidad to Canada way before I was born, my sister as well. And basically, like, then my mom moved to Toronto. They had me. I grew up in Toronto. Obviously, I'm a native. Well, not obvious to a lot of people, I realize, but I'm a native English speaker. My parents sent me to French immersion. So I learned French as a second language from the age of maybe five or so. But in a like Anglophone context, which is like another rabbit hole that's worth talking about, you know, anyways. And then in university, I decided to actually apply the French that I was learning. And I did, they call it a séjour linguistique. So I did 1 year abroad in France, in Rouen, which is a town in Normandy, which I do believe Theo or Theo Bull Bitcoin, I think they had an event there maybe last year or earlier this year. Yeah. And then I moved back to, like, to Toronto. I graduated debt free because I was like against debt from day one, thanks to my father, who is part of my Bitcoin story. And I met who would become my husband when I was in university. After a few years, he moved to Canada. And then so, like, you know, young couple, but not married, still figuring things out. He started working in Toronto, and then his office said, well, you know, we're going to move you to Switzerland, basically. And I was like, what? like huge, like,
change.
A big change, because I didn't know that much about Switzerland. And Toronto's a pretty big city. Like, so where I'm from is Scarborough. And then when I moved out, I think I was like 21 or something. I moved downtown. And so I'm accustomed to big cities. Like, I like New York. Well, I used to like New York, you know, well, I still do, but big city life was like the thing for me. Like, that's what I had in mind. And so when there were like Switzerland, Geneva, I was like, what's there? Like chocolate and banking?
Chocolate.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I need life, yeah. I need concerts and whatever. But we ended up moving here, and it was actually really, really, really like the one of the best things and best surprises to ever happen to me. Because contrary to what I thought, there are actually a lot of concerts here, a lot of live music and stuff.
Oh, really?
Oh my goodness. Okay, so see, distraction already. But the thing about concerts here is that some of the venues are so small and artists, I don't know what, well, they pass through because Swiss people don't really bother anyone. Like, the culture here is so respectful of whoever you are. It's about being yourself, but you're not going to impose things on someone else if they're not doing anything wrong, you know? So you have so many concerts, like Latin music, you've got rap music, you like Afro beats, you have everything, and they're in small venues. So sometimes you can actually like see the artist, meet the artist, talk to the artist. Like, it's really, really cool.
That's
and there's
cool.
Like a wide variety. I'm sure you've heard of the Montreux Music Festival that happens every year.
Yeah. I heard about that.
Yeah.
Well,
and
I've seen it on Instagram.
Yeah. And it's really nice. Before being a mom, you know, we'd go like in the summer and stuff, and it's just wonderful. And so like, this has turned into such a wonderful experience for me. And because here, I would say that the time preference is so much lower than it is in Toronto or New York, like in North America. And then learning about Bitcoin and being involved in the Bitcoin space, like, things just have like come together and added up and made total sense. So yeah, that's the like quick and dirty about my background and why I'm in Switzerland today.
But why do you say that the time preference is lower than compared to the other countries?
So small examples, grocery shopping, like just a regular example, grocery shopping, meal planning, making dinners and stuff. Mm-hmm. I was the type of person who didn't think ahead of time and I would just go grocery shopping at like midnight or something. You know what I mean? Okay. Like, it's like, yeah. Oh, I need this. Let me run to the store. Mm-hmm. Here, things close at like 8 o'clock is like les nocturnes. It's like the late night in Geneva. So if you don't have like your fridge stocked or whatever, you mm-hmm. can't go to the grocery store. You may have mm-hmm. to go out for dinner. Things are so much more expensive here than they were in Toronto. Like I remember being stuck on a Sunday with no food and going to a Chinese restaurant. And I was like, for like 3 spring rolls, I want to say it was like $20 or something. It was insane. So I was like, okay, this is why we need to like plan ahead. Do grocery shopping, like low time preference mentality, because nothing is available quickly and easily. You really have to work and build up for it. Another example. So when my husband, when he moved to Canada, we weren't married at the time, but I think it was like 3 or 5 years to obtain citizenship. And the sole requirement really was obviously you don't do anything illegal. And what was it? You had to be living in Canada, I think continuously without like leaving or anything for like 3 consecutive years or something like that. Here we became citizens and the process is like, I think it was 9 or 10 years. You had to have like a series of different permits, obviously continuous living in Switzerland. I had to write an essay about how I've integrated into the culture, what I appreciate about the culture. I had to do an oral French test.
Yeah, you told me about that.
To demonstrate my competencies in French, to demonstrate that I do pay attention to issues that are happening. And I'm not talking about like gossip issues, but like real issues, you know, because here it's a direct democracy. And so you don't just vote for like the president or the prime minister. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a series of referendums that happen. And mm-hmm. so you have to follow each topic and form a position on the topic before you vote. And so during the citizenship test, it was about, you know, like you have your C permit. What was the last issue that you voted on? Or what did you see? What did you think? Like, it's really, it's quite deep. And so I say that it's low time preference because it does take time to assimilate, to integrate, to understand what the issues are. And you have to demonstrate that sort of proof of work when you actually apply to become a citizen. That like the whole process was... It was just, yeah, I was like, whoa, this is because I was, you know, by my husband's side when he applied for his Canadian citizenship. He did have a test, that is true, but it wasn't to the same sort of level of, I guess, scrutiny and mm-hmm. and examination as like what we experienced here.
Yeah, and actually, it's really interesting because, do you know Samuel Kuhlman? I don't know if you have him in your show.
I think we follow each other, yeah.
Okay, but he's a politician from there. He has been in the podcast. We made an episode with Joel that he's from Relay. Yeah. And we were discussing about, because I asked him about the context of Bitcoin and politics and in Switzerland. And he told me that what you told me is a direct democracy. They even are not politician 24/7. It's like a part-time job, but then they have, all of them have a different job as well. So it's quite interesting, right? How it actually works. It's really interesting because I have learned that they actually can apply or to pass a law, they actually have to consult to everyone, basically, mm-hmm. to pass it, which normally the rest of the world is that you have, of course, you vote to have people that represent you and they make the laws and everything then and they pass it, right? But I think it's kind of course, it's not a decentralized method, but somehow it could be to make...
It
better.
Is really cool. So for a year, I organized the meetups here in Geneva, and uh-huh. we had Yves Benaim come in to present. So uh-huh. he is leading the initiative to add Bitcoin to the Swiss Constitution, uh-huh. which is someone that if he's available and if you're available, I think you should also have on your podcast to do a deeper dive. Totally. He is very well spoken. He's very like precise with how the process actually works and stuff. And so basically what the initiative is at this stage, it's about collecting signatures from the people to garner interest in this topic. And so it's, you have the initiative, the text has to be read by, I don't remember the name of the legal bodies, but just to make sure that it's not totally bananas. And then after that, the initiative is sort of distributed to the people. So it could be door to door. When you go to vote, oftentimes you'll see people outside of the voting station with a copy of their initiative, and they give you sort of the quick and dirty, and then you can read more if you want to. And then you literally, you have to write your name, your signature, where you live, your phone number, like everything has to check out to make sure that it's actual Swiss citizens who are interested in this topic. And then once 100,000 signatures are collected by the people who are heading the initiative, then it can go out for a vote amongst the entire Swiss population. So it's like, for me, that's incredible, because you really get a sense that when you're engaged in your community, when there's something that you believe in that you feel will actually make a positive change, you can do something, and it is possible to achieve a desired result. The initiative to add Bitcoin to the Swiss Constitution, it may not pass, but through the process, you're actually raising awareness about Bitcoin, about why someone would propose Bitcoin as opposed to gold, which I do believe is part of the current constitution. Why are people talking about Bitcoin? You know, like, why not just the Swiss franc? You know, like, it does provoke conversation. And I think that's sort of the bigger goal in all of this. But it's I know it sounds totally nerdy and dorky, but it's really cool to participate in something like this.
Absolutely. Well, now that you're talking about Bitcoin, that's actually was going to be my next question, that how do you first discover Bitcoin? Because you said that it's really attached to your journey.
Well, so I guess ultimately I have to thank my father, because my father is someone who has always had a natural curiosity for things and for life and how things work. And I remember in 2016, I was at business school. We were in actually Silicon Valley. We were pitching for a startup that's based in Switzerland that deals with like high-end art. And I haven't followed them since, but at the time they had this machine that did like 5D scanning, which is the digitization of art. And so what's the value proposition? You know, because here there are people who store some of their wealth, at least in art. And so we went through a number of different scenarios. How would they keep it? And the topic of blockchain came up. And one guy in my group who is from Prague, I think he lives in Prague. He's from the Czech Republic.
Okay.
The topic of blockchain came up, and he's like, that's not what blockchain is for, blah, 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 blah. And like, really sort of documented his reaction because it was strong. And I was like, that's good. Like, there's something there, you know, but I didn't follow up on it immediately. And meanwhile, my father and I have like these long-winded conversations about geopolitics, what's happening in the world. And he has I'm so, so grateful, but he's always been a gold bug, and he has raised like my sister and me with the notion of, if you can't afford it, if you can't pay for it in cash, you can't afford it. If, you know, like, save your money. Like, he was never into using debt as an instrument to get ahead, even though obviously they had student loans, they have a mortgage, or they had a mortgage, like, it was part of life. But he always instilled sort of the idea of sound money into me without actually saying sound money. He always spoke about gold, he always spoke about silver. And as a result, he watched the Kaiser Report. So he was like, in one of our conversations, he's like, Sai, you really need to tune into the Kaiser Report. And so I started watching. Initially, I was like, I don't know what they're talking about. Because I think at the time, Max Kaiser was talking about shorting JP Morgan or the silver squeeze or something like that. And so I was like, what is this about? And very quickly, I got hooked. And it was right after business school. And I remember thinking, why wasn't the topic of like central banking discussed in all of this stuff, you know, like why? And then since I've discovered like the M2 money supply, inflation, what inflation really is, which is increasing the money supply, I'm starting to understand and see the correlations between like the stock market in general and the increase in the money supply. I'm starting to understand that things aren't quite the way they've been presented to me by sort of official sources over the years. And so, I mean, I watched the Kaiser Report religiously. I loved that show. I saw Saifedean Ammous on there before he released the Bitcoin Standard. I saw Nick Bhatia, Adam Back, like all of the like the OGs and the people who were really instrumental in me learning or in my learning. I saw them on the Kaiser Report. And so once I got it, I was like, okay, this makes sense to me. This is home. And I have to admit that the bond that it sort of reinforced with my father really encouraged me to learn as much as possible. And then, like, I mean, I got orange pilled, obviously.
Cuando dejas tus activos digitales en un exchange o en custodia de alguien más, te expones a riesgos de terceros no deseados. A diferencia del sistema bancario tradicional, Bitcoin te permite tomar el control total de tus fondos utilizando tus propias claves privadas. Esto te permite ser soberano y esencialmente tu propio banco. Al tomar el control de tus Bitcoin, puedes evitar riesgos innecesarios de terceros. Almacenar tus Bitcoin en custodia de terceros como los exchanges puede exponerte a ataques de actores malintencionados, gobiernos o estafadores que lo único que quieren es apoderarse de tu dinero. Las billeteras de hardware aumentan la seguridad de tu billetera porque tus claves privadas se almacenan en un dispositivo especializado que no está siempre conectado al internet. Como te he dicho antes, mantener tus claves almacenadas en un dispositivo en línea puede exponerte a factores adicionales de ataque, por lo que se recomienda usar una billetera de hardware al almacenar grandes cantidades de Bitcoin durante largos periodos de tiempo. Jade es una billetera de hardware no custodial para Bitcoins y Liquid, que ofrece opciones de firma simple y firmas múltiples. Yo personalmente lo utilizo para almacenar mis bitcoins, ya que me siento mucho más seguro manteniendo mis bitcoins en una billetera fría que en una almacenada, por ejemplo, en mi teléfono. Si estás pensando en adquirir uno para ti, no olvides utilizar el código de descuento de nuestro show, BitCornerPodcast. De esta forma estarás apoyando directamente el show y además obtendrás un 10% de descuento para la compra de tu billetera fría.
That's so cool. You know that I don't remember if we had this conversation, we have the same background because I came into Bitcoin because of my dad as well.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So he's a pediatrician, and we start talking. I have told this story so many times in the podcast, but we have been talking about Bitcoins. But what actually I got curious about that is because. Because he's a pediatrician, he's not much into economics. I mean, he knows how to handle economics. He did a master's degree in economics because, I don't know, I think he had an offer in his job and he did it. Anyways, but that clicked to me because, all right, so this is not entirely, because I study engineering, so this is not entirely into engineering, so there's something hidden there. And it actually happened that my dad, he also watched Kaiser Report a lot.
Oh, really? Yeah.
A lot. But like every single week, he always send me through WhatsApp or Telegram, like, you should watch this clip or this episode. It was always Kaiser Report. And it was awesome because, yeah, that's how I started to get more curious into Bitcoin because as well, I saw even Jimmy Sun and all this guy that you mentioned. So I was like, all right, there's something here. And then I start digging. And by the way, now that you told me that your dad is a gold bug, has he read The Big Print for you? Otherwise, I really recommend it.
Oh, okay. So it is on my list of books to read, which is super long, but I will order it because I've seen a lot of positive reviews on X, and I've seen a few interviews with Larry Lepard. And so I think that it's worth reading. Just so, because I can say this, like my daughter is with my in-laws for a few days. I've just been like, oh my goodness, I've got time. And so I went through The Great Taking. Have you heard of this book?
Mm-mm. Mm-hmm.
So it is about, hold on, let me look up the name of the author so I don't get it wrong.
I'm going to take notes on this.
I think it was released The Great Taking by David Rogers Webb. It's only 90 pages, so it's a pretty quick read. But right. And I think was released in 2023 or 2024.
All right.
I can't believe I'm just hearing about this now. And uh-huh. Shout out to TK, who hosts the Orange Sun Twitter Spaces in the mornings, European time. Because
On Twitter, right?
Yeah. Oh, have him on your podcast too if you can.
We have something. We have something scheduled.
In the works. Okay, good. Because he mentioned it. Someone on the Orange Sun Twitter Space asked about lending against your Bitcoin and debt instruments, and I just said, you know, read the contracts really clearly, because especially as an individual, like retail borrower, you've got no rights. You are last in line. You're like, you have to be very careful with these contracts. And so TK was like, yeah, The Great Taking. I'm like, what? What's The Great Taking? I totally missed the release of this book. But essentially what's his name again? David Rogers Webb. What he's arguing in the book is that sort of ownership rules have been rewritten. It started in 2014 and it was just completed recently within the past 2 years. The collateral that someone puts up for their homes, whatever it is, that collateral is actually owned by a third party that doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily involve the borrower and the direct lender. So that mm-hmm. if things actually go under and the system implodes, your home, whatever you finance through debt, can end up in the hands of a third party that you're not even aware of. And his story is so fascinating. He talks about discovering this. So he used to work for a hedge fund. He's got a pretty long history in finance. And he said that in the 90s, okay, like decades ago, he discovered that the success of many companies within the stock market mm-hmm. was actually correlated to inflation, to the increase in the money supply. And he had mentioned it to some of the people that he worked with, and everyone brushed him off as a conspiracy theorist. But because he recognized this, he basically had a successful career betting against certain things because he saw the strong correlation. So basically, he demystifies this whole idea of growth and companies performing well. And what he's arguing is much of the success is actually attributed to the increase in money supply and where the Fed decides to inject money.
All right.
Very good book.
Yeah. It seems like that. And I think it's the perfect complement then to The Big Print, because what Lawrence Lepper had done in this book is that the TLDR is that his family, his dad and his grandfather, they have this company that they were gold bucks. So they have clients that invested in gold, whatever. So because he has three generations in his family, he has like a lot of information through, besides that, he's an astronaut in economics and he has studied about the US history and economy. He also have done some similar analysis actually about related to the inflation and the money supply. Whenever there's a crisis, that the US print more money. So he have described all the big crises, like the 2008, then the COVID crisis, and the way before, since 1971. And he had described them in order to people understand why the actual problem is inflation. And then he start telling that what will be a superior money to the fiat money, which is based on nothing or debt or credit. And he started talking about why he actually invested in gold until he found out about Bitcoin. And he found out that it was a superior money even from gold, and then explained why. So the conclusion of the story that he made is that eventually it will happen a big print, because now the big print means that everything is sustained basically in debt, but debt again is in everything. So the next time that they were gonna print money, on the contrary of 2008, that it was very specific on the real estates and banks and Wall Street, now it's in everything in life. So that will be a major crisis. And for him, this will be like a pivotal moment where people will start questioning that, all right, something is actually really wrong. Is there a solution? And eventually they will find out that there's a solution, which is Bitcoin. Yeah. So
yeah, I'm going to read that. That's it's amazing because I think before falling down this rabbit hole, I knew inflation was a thing. I saw like the prices increase, but I didn't take the time to really understand what inflation actually is. And I did get caught up with, you know, like it's inflation. Like inflation is just this thing that happens.
Exactly.
You know? Like it rains, there's inflation. Like it's just this natural thing that happens. And when you actually get into it, it's like there's such a like a range of feelings and emotions. I did feel, I guess, a bit of a sense of betrayal because I've always been one of those people who like I just applied myself, you know, like if I had to study something, I would study it. I would try to be like a good student, basically. Yeah. And so to come to the realization that it's like, no, sweetheart, you could try and you could study as much as you want, but you're not going to beat the system with the current rules because you're not part of the elite. You're not part of the chosen ones. You know, like you are not in the in-group. You're not privy to the real stuff that's happening in the economy. So as hard as you try, like you're still fighting a losing battle. And I'm grateful that I learned that in the era of Bitcoin. Because I think that if I'd learned that before Bitcoin was created, invented, whatever you want to say, like its foundation, its genesis, I think I probably would have felt kind of depressed and powerless because it's like, you know, you try so hard, you see like there's so much potential and stuff. And when you don't know how to break through and how to avoid a lot of these pitfalls that I see like my friends going through and certain family members, you feel hopeless. Like it's almost nihilistic.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another thing that just remind about this book is that Lepard is so brave because he actually provides some facts about, because he says that the Fed is a bank cartel. Of course you can say that, but other thing is to prove with evidence that why they, in fact, they're a bank cartel. And he described it in the book. It's so awesome. And the other thing is that, yeah, I had that same theme with, because I have some friends. Now I'm in a point, let's say in my life, that when I try to explain, because now I think everyone that it's close to me know about Bitcoin because of me. So besides that, but I, of course, you know, in Barcelona, you meet a lot of people. So when they ask me about what I do and I explain the podcast, Austrian economics, Bitcoin, whatever, there's a point that because they now I think it's a little bit changing that people, or at least the last one that I have talked with, they don't relate it with crypto, which is great, but they relate it with investment, which I think is good. But now I'm putting another filter that, yeah, you can see it as investment, but what I come from, in El Salvador, we use it as another tool. It's like literally what it says, electronic cash, peer-to-peer electronic cash system, right? So it's quite interesting because now I'm describing Bitcoin in another way, not just like, you know, like a supply that is finite and there will be more and it's not investing. So it's quite interesting. I think that, I don't know if it happens to you, but every single time my point of view, Bitcoin is changing a little bit into more deeper. And that's another question related to what I'm going to ask you right now, that why do you choose? First, what is your show for people that don't know what it's about? And then why you decided 21 questions?
So the name of my podcast is Ask a Bitcoiner 21 Questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole premise of it is to ask Bitcoiners from all over the world 21 questions. Initially, my jump off point was really to prove that Bitcoin is for anyone. I used to say for everyone, but I realized that if someone doesn't want it, it's not for them, right? So it's to demonstrate that Bitcoin is for anyone. And part of this, I would say, is probably in reaction to a highfalutin economist who said that Bitcoin was not inclusive. It was only for rich, sort of
the 1%,
like white
the top
men.
1%.
Yeah. And I was like, that is just pure dishonesty. You know what I mean? Like, that's not nice in the way. Absolutely. I like express myself. So it was like that was the jump off point. And so I launched it last year in 2024. And I'm so grateful because along the way, I've had contributors, specifically the Orange Manufacturing Group, who does editing and stuff. And they sell really, really cool Bitcoin accessories. You can check them out or go to one of the episodes and read the notes.
Yeah, I'm going to put in the podcast notes some of
your links. Oh, yeah. Okay, so awesome. Can check it out. And so actually, right after Barcelona, I have to say, so I'll say Miao, because I don't want to say his name as I know him. He led the design thinking workshop during the conference in Barcelona, and it was excellent. Like, it was really nice to just free my mind and to think about something else in a different way. It was so good. And coming out of the workshop, like, just, I felt kind of refreshed and stuff. And the spontaneous idea came to me and I was like, wait a minute. Part of my goal as well is to demonstrate that Bitcoin is really, you know, it transcends borders. It is for anyone. You know, you don't have to be part of a club. You don't have to be like a certain type of person and stuff. So it's like, wait a minute, why don't I just incorporate like QR codes in the sort of the lightning episodes where I ask people 21 questions in 10 minutes. And the first person to scan the Cashew eCash QR code retrieves 2,100 sats. Like, that is such a, like, a cool way without me saying all the time, you know, especially to people in my immediate circle, it's really for anyone. It's just like, look, watch this. I'm going to upload this video and someone is going to retrieve the sats. I have no idea who it is. I cannot control who gets it. It's just the first person who scans it gets it. And then, so I shared the idea with the Orange Manufacturing Group and he's like, yeah, totally. And he actually spoke to TK about Cashew and like, do you have any recommendations or anything? So we started creating those episodes. And then it was like, wait a minute, but we can actually do more. So in the full length interviews, we spread a 12-word seed phrase. It's hidden throughout the interview and it's sort of like masked in the background. So you have to pay attention. And so if you watch the full interview, you write down the seed words, you win 21,000 sats. You recover the wallet, of course, and you move the sats so that no one else has access to them. You get the sats. And so like the next episode that's coming out tomorrow with Adam, the Bitcoin Well, they've been very generous. They've decided to match the 21,000 sats. So whoever recovers the seed phrase will get 40, which is the equivalent of about $50. Like, that is so good. And it continues to spread the message that Bitcoin is for anyone, that if you watch and you pay attention and you recover the seed phrase, you can actually gain access to the sats. There is no intermediary. There's no middle person to say, no, you're not allowed to do that. I'm based in Switzerland. Adam's based in Canada. You could be based in Kenya, El Salvador, Argentina, like wherever. If you get the sats, that is for you. That's yours. And so that's the idea of the podcast. And it's really cool because we're finding different ways to engage with people while still communicating, you know, the importance of self-custody, what it means to hold your own keys, what it means to transcend borders and time and all of that stuff.
That's cool. Actually, this is a really good idea. I like that you do that. It's super
Thank
awesome.
You.
Yeah. It's a good way to prove actually that, in fact, Bitcoin is for anyone. Talking about games, I told you I also have games. So now is the time. We're in the middle of the episode. Yeah. So are you competitive as well?
I am. Oh, yeah. So part of my backstory is I played a lot of basketball and a lot of sports growing up as a kid. And that energy does not translate well in an office, for example, you know, like when you really just want to get things done and like whatever. Yeah. And so any opportunity to play a game, I'm very happy.
Okay. So we're going to do the first one, and then I think we're going to do both, because the second one, I think you should do this both, because the second one involved the people that we hang out in Barcelona. So I think so I think this will be really interesting. But first one, this is the first, the usual, let's say, game of the podcast. So you already know, guys, my previous guests have a question for my next guest. Sometimes it's a mess, you already know. Sometimes it doesn't correlate the questions, but everyone is included. And we continued the snowball effect. So today I'm going to show you the question from a previous guest, and by the end of the episode, you will have the opportunity to make a question for my next guest.
So when quantum computing is here, and we know that the old, you know, pre-2010 wallets are going to be exposed, but they haven't moved, do we as Bitcoiners have a responsibility to move those for them? Or do we just say, tough, we shouldn't touch them, but potentially a hacker drains those wallets?
That is a deep question. What do I think about that?
You can take your time about it.
Pardon?
You can take time to think about it. Yeah. While I prepare the other game, actually.
So with the way my brain works is, who would move those coins? Like, so if the Bitcoin community wants to be benevolent, I think I pronounced that properly, who would hold the role or take the responsibility of moving those coins, and what would they do with those coins? It's like, so my gut instinct would kind of say, if Satoshi or whomever, you know, holds those coins in the wallet, if they choose or cannot move them, is it really up to us to actually step in and do something? Like, there is someone behind quantum computing, right? Mm-hmm. If that were to happen, should we just let it happen? Do you see what I mean? Because then whomever decides to move the coins, what are they going to do with them? How will they redistribute them? Are they just going to, like, you know, send it to some, like, basically burn the coins by sending it to a wallet? Like, what is, yeah, I don't know.
No, yeah, I get you. Actually, I don't have a proper answer for them. I didn't think about it. But yeah, it's quite interesting. Actually, quantum computer, that's another rabbit hole. I don't know, have you talked about quantum computer in your show? I haven't.
I've touched on it briefly. I know that, so from what I understand, we still have maybe a decade or so to go before, or maybe a bit longer, I don't know, before that poses a real threat. And it's the like original wallets, what is it, P2K or something wallets that are impacted by quantum computing. It's not, you know, some of the most recent wallet addresses and stuff. And so I haven't paid it much attention because I don't see it as an immediate threat. Mm-hmm. But if I consider that within the Bitcoin community, there's always some kind of like debate. We don't agree on anything, on everything. There are always conflicts and fights. I think that addressing the threat of quantum computing is obviously legitimate because we want addresses that are quantum proof, so to speak. But then that doesn't solve the other problem of who, you know what I mean? Who is responsible for these coins that have moved? What does that say to the wider community? And how will they be redistributed? Like, I'm not sure that moving the coins would be the solution, but I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I have touched something about this in the podcast, but I can recall right now, because that's work that I have to do to make a little research. Because the thing is that I have started to do, so now I used to have it, I still have the newsletter, but sometimes I do like a research about some things. So when I do research about things, normally, because I do it by myself, one of the things that you probably rely on is that Bitcoiners, before knowing other Bitcoiners, is a lonely road. Until you meet these other crazy guys.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin has a lot of rabbit holes, and one of them is actually quantum computers. So I studied quantum computers actually in my career, but it's another rabbit hole. But recently I found it really fascinating because I read an article that it says that will actually quantum computers break? And actually, I wrote an article similar to that, like, well, actually, quantum computers will break the Bitcoin wallets, or actually Bitcoin. Then the short answer is...
They'll break Bitcoin itself?
Yeah, exactly, because in the sense that, because it's SHA-256, so the quantum computers will be managed to eventually find how to break all the encryption. The short answer is that, no.
No,
why?
Yeah.
The And the reason is because while the developers of quantum computers are helping the quantum computers itself to evolve, there's also developers that are working in security and cybersecurity and encryption in order to adapt to quantum computers. So in the same way that we have the daily life computers, we have evolved in that. For example, yeah. Now with an iPhone, we have the same or even more powerful computer power than a laptop, let's say,
yeah.
Where you can do. So it's the same correlation between quantum computers and every single technology and everything related to that. So it will be like hand by hand, right? So
yeah,
the same Bitcoiners will find a solution on that.
Yeah. And also, how much energy would be required to, like, if we think about this from, I guess, a very sort of basic perspective, how much energy would be required to maintain the quantum computing energy necessary to sustain an attack on Bitcoin?
That's a really good question.
Because, so my understanding, the little I've seen, is mm-hmm. that there is still quite a few years to go before mm-hmm. quantum computing could pose a threat to Bitcoin. And so mm-hmm. what will, you know, our energy resources look like at that time? Right now, there's a mad rush for AI. There's a mad rush for Bitcoin mining. It took, I think, a lot of sort of institutions that specialize in energy to understand how it is possible to mine Bitcoin in a decentralized fashion. You don't have to be, you know, right beside an energy grid to mine if you've got stranded gas, for example, on an oil well that can't be actually piped and actually utilized by people. You can just hook up miners there. I guess one of the things that's worth considering is the opportunity cost. Do you attack Bitcoin and try to bring it down, or do you utilize that energy to further mine Bitcoin in order to secure the network? And perhaps, I mean, the block rewards aren't going to be that high at that time, but still, you know, in fiat terms, the purchasing power from a block reward could still be relatively useful, especially if, you know, different sort of entities can access that energy relatively cheaply all over the world. So yeah, it's something that's worth investigating. It's not at the top of my priority list, but yeah. I guess I have more questions than answers with respect to quantum computing.
Yeah, actually, I remember why I started this. I was just checking my... Actually, I think I can share you this because I was checking the... I wrote this a long time ago, but let me check. I have the years here. Because my idea is that quantum computer is something that I really liked in the university, but didn't have the inspiration to start digging more until I find something related to Bitcoin. I was like, all right, I think I'm really early on this, so maybe I can start digging on it. And the same mission of Bitcoin that people say, well, but Bitcoin, it's so complex, I don't know, or economics, or I'm not a developer, that XYZ, right? So the same with my idea with quantum computers, like to show that it's actually not that complex, it's just another mm-hmm. science. And my idea was to write articles in the most simple way. Like, for example, the Schrödinger cat that people say, well, but that's so deep. Actually, no. And so anyways, I have wrote articles about that, and I just found a table I want to share with you that about the Bitcoin threat. Is this one? This one here. Look. So this is what I found about quantum threat level and Bitcoin response in 2024, last year, and then for the next couple of years, and then to 2040. So it says that from 2030 to 35, possible small-scale quantum decryption, but transition to quantum resistant algorithm begins. And then in 2040, plus, theoretical
first.
Yeah. And Bitcoin already adapted. And here are my sources. I can attach this to podcast notes so people
oh, yes, please.
Can check it.
Mm-hmm. I'll look at it. Yeah, but the time frame. So 2035, that's similar to what I'd heard, like 10 years out roughly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So yeah, we're still early. Yeah. So let me just close
when you said game, I wasn't expecting quantum computing. I was expecting like, woohoo, game.
No. We're going to the game. No. This is No. This is just a follow-up because I didn't know if you have to talk about quantum computer in your podcast.
No, but I should. I really should. That's
me too.
I will note that.
Yeah. No, the other game. There are some people involved that, you know, close to us, actually. And they're very competitive. So the next game, guys, you also already know it, but normally I don't play this game usually, but there are people involved in. So I should have done a bet on this. Shame on me. But the game is called the Alphabet Game. I just shared it on the studio chat, and I'm going to explain it because I need to explain to you, to the audience, because we usually don't play this game. But yeah, now it's going deeper. So the Alphabet Game is that it's a really silly game that you play
to see how fast you type
from A to C in order. Yeah. So the rules are, hold on, don't start.
Okay.
The rules are that you have 3 shots. We're going to keep your best timing. And when you finish, don't press enter. Otherwise, it will erase. So
it'll erase? Okay.
Yeah. Don't feel pressure, but these people is crazy. I don't know. I'll always ask this. Do you want to know the timing now or after you finished?
No, after.
All right.
But I will also say that I have a microphone in front of me. Had I known, I would have like made another arrangement. So let's see how I can do this. And plus, I'm wearing wired headphones. Short aside, I've heard, so Dr. Jack Cruz mentioned, maybe I shouldn't say this because you are wearing Bluetooth headphones, but I'll share the knowledge. So I usually record with Bluetooth headphones, and I heard Dr. Jack Cruz describe what happens because it's close to a certain part of your brain and it's not the best thing. And I thought, oh, you know, like parked into my brain. And then I saw Dr. Saifedean Ammous on X tweet something very similar maybe a month or two later. And I said, you know what? I don't know about, I'm not a medical professional and stuff, but maybe I should consider, you know, heed the words of wise men. And so I went to a wired headset. Why am I saying this? It's on my keyboard. So it's getting in the way of my typing.
All right. You know that Theo and Science and Kiki are going to watch this and they will say bullshit.
Bullshit. It's because they work for Bull Bitcoin. So of course they're going to say bullshit. Right. Trash talk. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So you have 3 shots. And of course, because we don't trust, we verified, then you need to send me a screenshot of your best timing. And you will see that.
Of my timing, okay.
Mm-hmm. You will see that. So you can start whenever you want. Just let us know.
Okay. I thought there was a countdown or something. Okay, first time.
No, I mean, you will see.
Just stopped. I started and I stopped because you said something. What do I do?
Let me finish and then you start. You'll have the trigger.
So do I delete or I hit reset?
Just press enter and you will start again. But the thing is that at this moment, doesn't matter because I put some effects and I make it super fast in the podcast. So it's kind of silly and interesting, but people will see it in post-production. Right? Really, really nice.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
So I can start now.
Yeah, you can start. Now the pressure is in.
Go ahead. I'm taking the headset off too.
All right. Wow. Wow.
Okay, so what's the score? Is it like 2 seconds?
Actually, the best score, I don't know how he managed to do this, is Jordi. Jordi has what is Jordi? 5. Well, you'll see right now.
That is a very good game.
Yeah, it's a pressure on it. Actually, Science have a different version on this that probably we'll use it in the podcast.
I'm gonna nice. Discuss.
Yeah. But that's more pressure. His idea, I like his idea. We're going to do it probably next season on the podcast.
Very nice.
Yeah. Dang, we already have almost an hour. But yeah, we're going to start wrapping up. Probably I'm going to make you just 2 more questions because there's so much things. But yeah, time flies. With this game, time flies.
It does. This is a good game. Really good game. So are you going to start giving out sats to the winners? Or like...
That's it. Yeah. So my original idea was to make... During Barcelona conference, I wanted to do this live. But because we were hanging out and talking and whatever. So it was kind of a mess. So the idea was to make like a kind of a jackpot. So people bet like 210 sats, and eventually the best one in the end will get all the money. So yeah, so let's say this season is just to see who is the best one, but the next one, yeah, it will be with money, with sats. And the best one by the end of the season will get whatever X money is involved.
That's a really good idea. Every, mm-hmm. like when you come on, the, yep, 210 sats, that's good.
And they will have more pressure. Imagine you have pressure right now without money. Now imagine with knowing that you will probably lose money or earn
it. So the next time I will say that it'll be sign language only. You'll just give me a visual cue. You'll be like, Stark, because I'm like,
damn it.
Like my desk space is not conducive for winning.
Wow. All right.
It's a good game.
Yeah, it's a really engaging game, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's start wrap it up. And actually, this is the part that I always struggle with because I want to cover a lot of things. But yeah, I don't know. First, I think I'm going to ask you before I forget, anything that you want to add before I ask you that my two probably want to last question, anything that you want to add that probably I didn't ask or didn't have in mind? And do you want to add?
No. Yeah, no, because we're wrapping up and stuff like that. And yeah, no. It'll be, I guess, for the next time or something. And I can't think of anything offhand.
All right. So my next question is that now that we have talked about your background, your rabbit hole journey, and about Bitcoin, what is the most valuable thing that Bitcoin have provided to you? And whenever I talk about this, it's not about the monetary value, of course.
Exactly. It's like the most valuable things, plural.
All right.
Bitcoin has brought to me. I would say, so I guess I'll start high and go deeper.
Yeah,
optimism, please. Definitely. So I started to take Bitcoin seriously in 2017. Time, experience, and observation have shown me that despite being called horrible things and being dismissed by people that I once admired and stuff, time has shown that I don't want to speak in absolutes because you never know, you know, and I'm a little superstitious, but so far it would seem as though I understood, you know what I mean? It's also like, I guess, reinforced the bond that I have with my father. And so that is obviously very important. Like he was on my podcast as well, talking about it. It's allowed me to meet people that I probably would not have met and see that, you know, like even though we're from different places and stuff, I didn't mention, but I did visit El Salvador, thanks to Max and Stacy, because they spoke about it in 2022. And my daughter was there as well. Like she went to Hope House. Like it's just all of these experiences and meeting people and just exchanging ideas where I used to think I was super weird. And it turns out that, you know, I'm like, there are many of us, if you will. So that sense of just, I guess, belonging and stuff that I'm discovering through Bitcoin, and then just, I guess, peace of mind, security. It's all of these things together that I don't have one word for, but it things just get better with time on a Bitcoin standard.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to change my last question because now that I know that you went to El Salvador, it's more important because this is a Salvador and Bitcoin podcast. So yeah, let's go a little. I think this is a good way to finish the podcast, actually, talking about your experience there. What was in general more about your experience? Because right now, I'm bringing this because right now, I think people have forgotten, especially Bitcoiners. And that's something that it doesn't annoy me, but it's like, guys, you're missing the point that now with all the IMF things that is happening and the loans or whatever, people have forgotten or they don't want to see. I don't know how to describe it. I always struggle with this, that there are actually Bitcoin grassroots project in El Salvador and actually happening. They haven't stopped. It's not related with the government. They don't work with the government. Like Mi Primer Bitcoin doesn't have to deal with us. And even no nation that it's part of the Bitcoin office, which is part of the government, but still whatever the IMF says, they keep teaching kids about Bitcoin and the technical part, but also the monetary part and the Austrian economics part. So yeah, I just want to hear your experience, your personal experience about that. And because yeah, that's something that I want to to share with also with the audience that are non-Salvadorans, and that's why I also bring people from outside the El Salvador, but also Salvadorans to share different perspectives from the people that are actually working in El Salvador, but people that have been to El Salvador, and compared to that, if that contract, if it's actually happening or not, because actually that's some of the things that I actually like about Bukele, that says, don't ask to the press, come to El Salvador and experience by yourself. So I want to know your experience. Probably it's false, everything that I have said, but or no. But
well, I mean, the fact that you said, don't ask the press, come to El Salvador yourself, I think pretty much encapsulates the journey before we actually got on the plane. So the Kaiser report ended. I was so sad. And like, I went through withdrawal symptoms. You know, I really loved that show. And then Max and Stacey had the Orange Pill podcast that I watched. And I think it was during that time that they started to speak more and more about El Salvador. They were talking about like the fentanyl crisis in the US versus the prosperity, what did Stacey say? The Enlightenment age, the Renaissance that's happening in El Salvador. That's the term she used. And I was like, because, you know, like her daughter wasn't in school yet. I think she was 2 or 2.5. And so it was very easy just to pick up and travel. You don't have to worry about, you know, school stuff. And so I said to my husband, I said, you know, for our, I think it was the Easter vacation, maybe it was in April that we went. I said, let's go to El Salvador. And so he was like, okay, because before being married and before having a child, like we've both traveled all over the world. Like I've been to like a few African countries. I've been to India. I've been to China. I've been to Russia. I've been to Costa Rica. Like I've been to a lot of different countries and stuff. And so I didn't have like fear of travel the way like other people may have. And so we went on the embassy website in Switzerland and in Canada, and it was like travel warning, you know, dangerous country, don't go. And I was like, I don't think that
back in 2020, maybe
20 years. No, it was 2022.
Oh, okay.
2022. Yeah. And so I was like, I don't think that like Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert would risk their reputation if it was really still that dangerous. I have a cousin who I called him and I was like, yeah, we're thinking of going to El Salvador. And he was like, no way, because there's like a gang or something, M13 or 16 or I don't know, some kind of gang.
That's a little thing, yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, I don't know that world. So I was like, are you sure it's really dangerous? Because, and then I started seeing more and more things come up on Twitter about how the country is turning around and the steps that Bukele is taking. And Bukele, you know, he was into Bitcoin before he became president and stuff. And so I thought, this is one of those situations where someone is not telling the truth. And by that someone, I was like, I don't think these media reports, and I don't think that like the Canadian government or the Swiss government were intentionally misleading, but I do think that perhaps there was no one on the ground to verify these travel alerts and travel warnings and whatever else. And so this is to tell you, like with my daughter who was 2, we still got on the plane and we still went despite all of the FUD. And I mean, like the trip in itself, because it was like coming out of COVID, you know, you had to wear a mask in the airport. As soon as we got on the plane, we were sat close to a former pilot. He's like, you don't need your mask. Take it off. You know, so like we took the mask off. We landed in Florida. We were with the flight crew and they're like, where are you guys from? Switzerland. How was COVID lockdowns in Switzerland? And I was like, well, you know, it wasn't so bad in our village. Like we could go outside and stuff like that. It wasn't as bad as what we saw in France.
Yeah.
And one of the flight attendants, she was like, yeah, that was some bullshit. You know, I went boating and I did this and I did that. We're fine, like Florida, you know? And I was like, this is actually kind of cool. Like so far, no complaints.
Absolutely.
We spent the night in Florida. We flew from the airport there to El Salvador. We arrived like, and it was just nice. It was nice. There was a driver. We stayed in El Sante at the Garten.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
You know, I paid the driver in sats. Everything was fine. I didn't see people wearing masks or anything like that. We were on the beach. people were nice. We had a driver take us to San Salvador. We did a tour. We saw the church. We heard of Las Mujeres, I think, the story of the women during the war. I could be wrong.
No.
We had... Go ahead.
No. Yeah, there's a story about that during the Civil War,
probably? Yeah.
Ah, okay, yeah. I don't recall the name, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I think that's what it is. I have it written down somewhere, but... I mean, we were there as tourists. I bought pupusas in Bitcoin, like on the side of the road. I remember seeing tamarind balls, which is something, if you know me, you know about tamarind balls, which are, you know, in Trinidad, they are so good. My Auntie Jean makes them. Like, I love tamarind balls. So I was like, whoa, you can buy tamarind balls in Sats. Like, and it was a beautiful experience. And speaking to the driver going to San Salvador from El Sante, he explained, I want to say that maybe he was in his 30s. So he explained how things were before Bukele, how things were at that time in 2022, the hope, the optimism, the openness. He said, you know, before you can go to this neighborhood, now mm-hmm. things are okay. We saw other Canadian tourists there as well, I think the husband is from Canada, the wife is from El Salvador. And he said, and they were there with their two kids. And he said, you know, a few years ago, we didn't come because my in-laws were saying that it's still dangerous. And now here we are because things are turning around. Like the threat of like immediate danger and all the stuff that we saw, you know, on these websites, it just wasn't true. Like my daughter, we met Roman Martinez. We went to Hope House. My daughter did. They have the pastor who gives a service outside. My daughter participated. There was the cleanup on the beach. There was playing in the water. Like, it was just nice. It was like family fun because those are the types of activities that we did. And it was a lovely trip. Like the black sand beaches in El Sante, we saw people surfing. Like, I mean, I was like, this is, there are parts of like Paris where I would not step foot. You know, there are so many places in Europe where I would never go because that's real danger. But, you know, where we stayed, the activities we did and stuff, perfectly safe. We got free mangoes as well because the mangoes were ripe. I remember looking up and one of the guys who works at the hotel, he's like, oh no, I'll get you mangoes. And he brought back like a box filled with mangoes. We couldn't eat them all. And I was like, this place is so lovely. I don't live there. I don't pay taxes there. I don't know what the daily life is like. But as a tourist, I will say that there is a stark contrast between what was being reported and what we actually lived. Like it was just lovely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Don't talk about mangoes. My mom sent me. My mom always told me like, do you know, send me pictures, tell me, do you know what it is? And mom, it's mangoes. Because the thing is that because people have a lot of trees that produce a lot of mangoes, so people start just giving away because otherwise you will like, you know, there's so, as you mentioned, there's so much mangoes that people cannot eat all of them, so they just start giving away to everyone. But I'm glad that you have a good experience, Salvador. I always ask about that because, yeah, there's different stories. Even the people that say, no, I didn't like Salvador just because it's not my favorite. It's okay. But I want to know the experience of the people, Bitcoiners or not Bitcoiners, that have been on Salvador and the experience in the first place. But all right, Saida, we're going to make another episode probably with other guys. with the French guys.
And I'm going to win next time.
Yeah, that will be a good episode, actually. But thank you for your time. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, I'm gonna add to the podcast notes your links and works. Guys, watch her show because it's really cool. And
thank you.
Yeah, and guys, see you next week. Thank you, Saida, for being the podcast. Ciao.
Bye, thank you.